Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. I'm here at the Locarno Festival in Locarno, Switzerland. I haven't been here for a couple of years, but I'm back. I'm very happy to be back, if only for one film that we're going to talk about that pretty much kind of makes the whole trip worth it. Although, of course, there's much else here. And I'm very pleased to be kicking off the Locarno podcast with Jessica Kian.
Hello, Nick. How's it going?
Very well. With this lovely air view of the mountains.
We are on a balcony.
On a balcony, yeah. It's quite nice. The weather's been nicer than I remember it. I remember being here once. It was like a cauldron. I just felt like it was very humid, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be hot for the rest of the time. But like, and the first day I arrived, it absolutely poured with rain, which is kind of fun, ruining everybody's shoes. And so everyone invested in one of those leopard spotted ponchos.
Oh, okay.
Which are very cool, but extremely unflattering on everyone. But so it's kind of a great leveler in a way.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot of leopard print here. That's the norm, pretty much. So, I mean, do you have anything general you want to say about the festival? How long have you been going here for a few years?
I come here off and on. It's not one I attend religiously by any means. I have also a strange background with Locarno because my mother is actually from here, my grandmother, and there's a house, which always sounds so fancy to say, we have a house in the hills in Locarno. It's this really tiny, very impractical house that's like literally built on the side of a really steep hill, and there's no air conditioning and it's full of mosquitoes and the hot water doesn't work. So just in case people are getting the impression that I'm some sort of landed gentry person.
Oh, the house in Locarno.
Yes, let's go to the house in Locarno. So I have like, with the town of Locarno itself, I have like a long history that, you know, goes back to summer holidays when I was a kid and visiting my grandmother here. And ironically enough, it's also partly as a result of that, it's a town that I actually have a lot of criticisms of, I think. I've never been particularly in love with it. It's a very beautiful place. Mm-hmm. And I know I tend to denigrate it a little bit. When my ex-boyfriend first came here, he was just like, is this the place that you've been complaining about all the time? It's gorgeous. And it is really beautiful, situated on a lake, fantastic mountains around, and you know, the water is very clear. But then there's also very annoying things about it, one of which, the most obvious of which, is just the incredible expense. It's extraordinarily expensive. And so things like that kind of annoy me about it. And historically, the Locarno Film Festival itself has been one that I've had a kind of a very ambivalent relationship with as well. I haven't really been necessarily a fan of its programming for quite a while. And I think a couple of recent changes that have happened in the last few years. I mean, it's gone through quite a few artistic directors in the last 5 years or so. Mm. And that has also kind of contributed to the feeling of it being slightly schizophrenic at the moment. I'm not sure it's quite settled down into, you know, having its distinct identity. I tend to be a little bit down on Locarno. And as a result of which, this year so far, I mean, we're only a few days into it, but has been a really pleasant surprise because I've seen quite a lot of really good stuff and one truly outstanding film, which we're about to talk about.
Yes. So let's just dive into that because it is such a great movie. And I was just saying that, you know, I kind of hope I will watch it again while I'm here, which is not a luxury that you can usually do. And it is a longish movie, so it might not be possible. But that movie is the new film from Radu Jude, the kind of one man's second coming of the Romanian of Romanian cinema.
Yes, the new wave.
The new wave. The title is
Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World, which is just a fantastic title and makes increasingly more sense as you're watching the film. Initially, I'm even writing in my review at the moment because I'm currently in the middle of reviewing it. Radu Jude, because of his last few films, he's one of those filmmakers where to actually just mention his last few films uses up about half of your word count in your review. So obviously he is the Berlinale Golden Bear winning director of Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn.
I think, I mean, in some ways you can regard this film, his new film, as the final installment in a kind of a thematic trilogy, which isn't necessarily his last three films because there have been documentaries and other sort of more minor films in between. But certainly in my mind, I bracket it with I Do Not Care If We Go Down in History as Barbarians, which was his 2018 film that won in Carlo Vivari. And prior to this one, I think was my favorite Rowdy Judah film. Again, very experimental and quite long, and these incredible digressions that have the habit of sort of like elbowing their way into the foreground and becoming like subtext becoming text almost. And then of course, Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn, which won the Golden Bear in Berlin, which is even more sort of scattered and frenetic, and was also divided into very distinctive kind of sections, which in some ways did and in some ways didn't really refer to each other. And I actually think that all of those impulses come together in the best way, actually, in Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World, his new film, which is simultaneously like completely chaotic and anarchic, and yet totally controlled. From the outside, it just seems like a huge mess. And then when you're in it, when you're experiencing it, it becomes clearer and clearer that there's a real rigor to it as well. There's a real rigor to its construction. And what is my favorite thing about it, and it's been my favorite thing about a few films I've seen this year, I think it's particularly resonating with me, is that it basically amounts to an anti-work manifesto, I think. It's like about, you know, just the actual lunacy that is our work culture at the moment, and the especially with the gig economy and all of those things, but not even just that, it's a wider philosophical idea about why it is we have sort of internalized this notion that in order to live, we must work, when work is the thing that is actually going to kill us all.
Yeah. That's very succinctly stated and so compelling.
Yeah.
He does all of this with just such a... The thing that kept coming to mind after I watched it is that, like, is anyone having as much fun as Rowdy Judah is right now making movies?
I don't know. And certainly nobody is doing it as mischievously. He's like some sort of like trickster god type of person. And like one of the things I was really amazed by is just like, it's, I don't know how you can have this kind of perspective on now while we're still in now. Mm-hmm. This film feels like it was literally finished 4.5 minutes ago. And, you know, as soon as you watch it, you're like, how can he possibly have made this expansive 2 hour, 43 minute long movie, and completed it and edited it and all of those things. And yet for it to feel like it's been ripped from literally today's headlines. And he has this amazing, it's also the part and parcel, I think, of its very outwardly scattered approach, is that he comes at this issue from all sides simultaneously. In my review, actually, I have it like he somehow manages to both be the schoolboy who's holding the magnifying glass and be the ant who's burning up underneath the magnifying glass. So it's somehow we managed to get the bird's eye helicopter view perspective on this massive issue that he is bringing to light, and also this incredibly eccentric and singular portrait of one person through whom all of this is then sort of filtered. And this is the amazing actress Ilinka Manolache, who is truly fantastic in the central role. And again, it's just that act of alchemy where you can read so many generalizations into this character, but she never feels like anything but like a really specific, really brilliantly embodied, completely peculiar character herself.
I mean, she is, I don't know, what are the different ways you could describe her? I mean, because she has a thriving like artistic life of her own, in the sense that she has this TikTok character that she does, where she has this filter of Andrew Tate,
yes, she even mentions it at the very beginning.
Yeah. With, you know, this pronounced unibrow sort of situation. And her job as production assistant, they are, I mean, constantly throwing different things at her, and a lot of it boils down to shuttling people around the city, which it almost makes it feel like she's kind of an Uber driver while being like a production assistant, which is a kind of neat thing to fold into it. Although she's not actually literally an Uber driver, but gets the sense of just like having to be constantly on. And she's saying like, I have to have the music playing because otherwise I'm going to fall asleep.
Yes.
You know?
And at one point she even like pulls into the side of the road and has to take a nap because she's literally falling asleep at the wheel. I mean, the actual story, I guess, of this incredibly complex film is it does follow her. Her name is Angela. And the first section, so the film is divided into two chapters, as you mentioned. And the first chapter, which is by far the longer one, the very mischievous title that comes up at the very beginning of it announces that it is in dialogue with another film, a 1981 film called Angela Moves On, the star of which then turns up in the modern day sections, which are with our Angela. She is also called Angela, so many, many doublings and layerings and sort of parallels drawn between these two women. So the star of the 1981 film, who is herself a Bucharest taxi driver, who gets sort of embroiled in various romantic, as we glean from the scenes that we see of that movie in this one, is embroiled in various sort of romantic encounters, but while also being constantly in her car because she's a taxi driver. So that's one of the chief parallels that we see, is just between these very two women with these very busy lives, most of their days being spent inside a car. And it's the same for modern day Angela. She is in her car like so much, and there are as frenetic and as sort of loaded with, as you say, the TikTok references. She has this character called Bobita, who she calls Bobita, who is, yes, an incredibly profane, incredibly offensive, satirical character that she sort of, it almost seems to function to me like a pressure valve. Yeah. For this just shit that is building up. You see so much of her interactions, even with other motorists, that all have this edge of sexism. She herself is a beautiful blonde. Is in this sort of like sparkly mini dress the whole time. Yeah, a party dress, and she gets horrible sexist comments leveled at her by other motorists and things, and she responds in kind. I mean, she takes absolutely none of the shit, or she certainly gives it back treblefold. But one of the ways, I think, one of her outlets and one of the things that weirdly seems to keep her sane is this Bobita character that she has, that where she records these skits essentially on her TikTok with this incredibly ugly filter. I mean, it's super grotesque.
Yeah.
The look of these things is just really horrendously ugly, and sort of deliberately so.
And then the content is ugly too.
The content is incredibly ugly. It's hate speak. It's just nothing but hate speak. It's like pure misogyny, hate speak, and
reactionary.
Yes, and one of the ways in which, again, this film feels so ridiculously current is like the day that I saw it was also then the day that it was in the news that Andrew Tate himself had just been released from house arrest in Romania, where he has been held for the last while. And he's like on some other version of house arrest where he can actually leave the house, but he's still, going to be there until his trial happens, which they reckon won't happen for a few years. And his trial is obviously on rape charges and sex trafficking charges and all sorts of truly grim things for the self-confessed misogynist that he is. And so her character that she plays, this Bobita character that she plays, is simultaneously exactly that and also a satire on it and a riff on it. And it's almost, even the how crude that filter is, and because she moves quite a lot, the filter doesn't quite track to her movements.
Right.
So you constantly are aware that it is her, like this pretty blonde woman spewing these incredibly profanity-laden hate-speak speeches. And it almost, I think, for her seems to function as this outlet valve for stuff that would be building up otherwise. And not like that even then in her everyday life. So she is constantly on the go. She's constantly being pulled, like her phone with that horrible MIDI version of Beethoven's Ode to Joy is constantly ringing, and it's always to send her over to the other side of Bucharest to pick up something or other, to do some other dog's body work that she has to do. And she complains about it. So she's very aware of her own exploitation. She's also extraordinarily bright. Like, there's no doubt that this character, when we're first introduced to her, when she's being woken up by her alarm clock at 5:50 a.m., and beside her on the bedside table, there are like empty beer bottles and a copy of Proust. And it's just like, but and you realize later she's read that copy of Proust, like, and she has absorbed that copy of Proust. She's super smart, and she has all sorts of weird references that like range from being incredibly highbrow to being incredibly lowbrow. And every single encounter that she has, she usually pitches in a joke. She actually will do the whole, have you heard the one about, with maitre d's in restaurants and with these interviewees who, because it's her job this particular day, because it's mostly the first chapter, I think, is basically pretty much a day in her life.
Yeah.
And her job that particular day with this production company is to go and interview people who have been injured in workplace accidents as a result of this particular Austrian company that is working in Romania, because the corporate Austrian overlords, represented by Nina Hoss in an amazing cameo, they have commissioned this production company to create a safety at work video. So it's this really ridiculous exercise in corporate ass covering, basically, that they're doing. And she is expending all of this energy in order to go to these various houses where people who have actually been injured in workplace accidents can tell their little stories. And she films them and then sends them up to the Austrians so they can decide which one is like telegenic enough or which one is on message enough to then be able to get the £1,000 or whatever it is they're offering in order to be the sort of spokesperson for their safety at work campaign. So like all of these issues about the corporatization and the nature of the gig economy and the fact that these people, all of whom really want to get cast in this role, despite the fact it is completely, you know, ultimately counter to the interests of the workers, and they themselves who have been grievously injured or maimed at work should obviously be, you know, having some solidarity with the other workers, but instead they just need the money. They need the fucking $1,000 that they're going to get for this, or 1,000 euros. And so it just becomes this endless cycle of exploitation, and of actually, even when we're aware that we're being exploited, it's almost like we're too busy negotiating the terms of our own exploitation to be able to do anything about that exploitation. There's amazing, amazing little asides. I mean, gosh, this film is just so full, like every 5 minutes is so full of ideas. Yeah. But there's amazing asides about that exactly. And one of the ones yet another thing that occurred to me while I was thinking about the film again was just that aside that he has about Georges Méliès, about how one of Georges Méliès' first jobs was commercials. Right. He actually, and I looked it up, this commercial for this mustard. So one of the characters in the film is, you know, kind of, I guess, defending the fact that they are making this this corporate safety video with the fact that, like, from the earliest times of the earliest cinema, one of the uses to which it's been put has been advertising, and mentions this thing about Georges Méliès making an ad for mustard. Yeah. And I looked it up, and Georges Méliès did actually make an ad for mustard. Apparently he made 20 to 25 advertising films, as they were called at the time, in the year 1900. They've all been lost, but it is on record that that is actually true.
And they're kind of talking themselves in circles a bit, I felt. You know, it's like they're trying to do this ad, but they're also like, and we're going to do it with Cook lenses. You know, like these really high-quality lenses. You know, it's like, okay, sure, like whatever you can eke out of this experience, you know.
Exactly.
Which I also thought was so true, which is that you have to be doing these things to live. So you're like, you're trying to like find some way that, you know, you're going to get some satisfaction or some actual like artistic accomplishment out of it, or maybe even just some equipment. I don't know, you know. So that's that kind of constant hustle that's going on.
Yeah, it's hilarious, but it's also really revealed, I think, to be the overarching fallacy, right? It's that somehow we're going to be able to work within the system that is exploiting us, and we're somehow going to be able to eke out some form of satisfaction or some career kind of fulfillment within a system that is actually designed to exploit us and doesn't give a shit about our fulfillment. Yeah. And actually how much of that is wasted effort on our parts and wasted energy. One of the great like overriding things I felt about this film was just because she is such an amazing character, and you kind of, you feel for her and you love her so much, and she is so bristlingly bright and so full of creativity and so full of energy, and she's wasting it all. It is all being wasted on this fucking corporate video. Like this, just is in this one day, this blazing character really expends so much, you know, just creative energy in getting from one place to another, in the way she interacts with everybody, which she seems to meet everybody on their very own terms, and they all respond to her in kind. So, you know, every single one of those encounters is exhausting, and yet there's something really human and beautiful about those encounters. And yet they are all ultimately in service of this Austrian company that basically wants to cover its ass because its safety standards are pretty lax.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, and whenever you get a chance to hear her talk about just anything cultural, it's just like this, you know, sudden like geyser of life. You know?
Yes.
It's, just,
yeah.
It's so wonderful. And like, even when she has to drive like the Nina Haas character at one point, which is this great mini movie in itself, like in, you know, encounters between two worlds. They just talk about music because, and I don't know, I thought that scene was amazing in terms of like manager personality, which,
yes,
and also she's thinking, oh, what can I get out of this ride? Or, oh, I'll ask her about this new music I heard about, you know?
Yeah.
And she's like, do you know anything about this turbo? And she's like, yeah, turbo folk. Yeah, I guess I listen to that sometimes. They also, that's an example of how these details that feel very specific, you know, she puts that music on. They have like this unexpected montage at one point of like roadside memorials,
which is introduced in that scene.
Yeah, because
she actually is telling the Nina Haas character about this stretch of road in Romania,
yeah,
outside Bucharest, where there are more crosses than there are miles in the road. Like the road is 250 kilometers and there's 600 crosses,
yeah,
for people who have died on that road. And then very abruptly, and it's kind of signals the end of that first chapter,
yeah,
and it's like 2 hours into the film, we go into this montage, a completely silent, like a lot of the movie has been very jaggedly sound edited as well.
Yeah.
The sound edits between the modern day footage and the old movie as,
yeah,
well are often really abrupt and very jarring.
Yeah.
Some of the old movie, Angela Moves On, is shown in slowed down footage, which warps the sound as well. And,
yeah,
and there's really interesting things going on with sound and with music, with like ambient music. So it's been very kind of loud and you know, frenetic. And then there's just this absolutely silent sequence of, a friend of mine counted them, 115 shots.
Wow.
They're about 3 seconds each of these roadside crosses, which she has just mentioned to the Nina Haas character while driving her from the airport to her hotel. And then suddenly we go into this, and it's this, after all of the jokes and after all of the kind of anarchy, it's this really somber moment. And it almost functions to me like the moment of the car crash. So much of what we're talking about is like set in a car, and it is motion. It is very dynamic. It is, even though she's moving back, you know, she's not really getting anywhere. She's moving backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
It's still, there's still a really kinetic sense of this. And even, you know, I think Judah also wants to reveal that itself as a lie as well. The idea that we might think that we're going anywhere,
right,
when in fact we're just going oscillating back and forth and back and forth, and then there's a crash. And so I think that this, it's a very eloquent and really somber statement of that, where you have these crosses and just these still completely silent shots of these, the roadside crosses, which, because that story that she tells about that road is in fact a real road, and there are in fact more than 600 crosses of dead people who have erected to dead people who have died on that road. So it suddenly becomes like the barrier that you crash into. Which then also then introduces the very different, determinedly, completely oppositional aesthetic of the last, of the second chapter, which is the shooting of this safety commercial thing itself, safety promo itself, which is all done in one locked off shot, which lasts for, I guess, 40 minutes or something. And the whole scene goes on. But so it's the family who they have chosen out of the people whom she was interviewing the other day, them all sitting, you know, facing the camera. And basically all of the action of the film happens off camera. We hear it in the dialogue. We hear it from what the director is telling the actress to do. You do see a little bit of the interaction between them. We see Angela at one point walking past in the background doing a particularly virulent Bobita section, which is honestly hair-raising, even though you know it. In the context of her, it's a satirical piece. I was just like, Jesus, are you allowed to say that in a movie? Yeah, so, and that's that completely, like, aesthetically opposed to everything that's gone before, but thematically really an incredible development, an incredible, incredibly rich way to kind of embody everything that he's already been talking about.
And it also almost felt like he was containing like one of the earlier styles of like Romanian New Wave, because I think one of the earlier films that's not, I wasn't a huge fan of, was about the filming of a commercial. Do you remember that one? The Happiest Girl in the World.
Yeah. It was his debut feature, I think.
So that's kind of funny that, you know, and then put to an entirely new purpose here. And I just want to mention again, like, about those, that 1981 movie that they pulled in, because I'm still kind of unpacking the different ways that it's being used. Because, in some, you know, obviously it's this very just like sealed off surface, because it's this, you know, looks like it's ready for TV sort of thing, where she's going through these packaged melodramas. That so it's just interesting to see that and see how, what he's extracting from it. And I guess he must have really enjoyed working with that old footage, because there was like immediately a story that his next movie or one of them is going to be a found footage.
Ah, that's right. Yes. So, well, I mean, he's worked in found footage before. He's done some found footage docs before. But yes, he's, I think I'm in two minds actually about how that, very appropriately in two minds about how that the 1981 film is used, because the part of me wants to do kind of, I guess, the more obvious thing of saying, like, these are the parallels between that Angela and this Angela.
Right.
And then part of me is like, but also, it's kind of also there to show how completely different it is as well. And how completely, like, the 1981 footage, even the fact that he sometimes slows it down, it seems to me entirely, and her life, even though it's also very car-bound, it seems to have, like, a space in which she can think and reflect about things. The 1981 Angela is, it's almost a sort of like slightly nostalgic thing. I'm not sure if the film itself is actually her in the car reminiscing about these various encounters that she had, or if it takes place in a more sort of obviously chronological way. However, the feeling that we get, and maybe that's also partly just to do with this vintage, nice color photography that we have, and the old cars and everything's going around these old roundabouts, you get the sense that there is a slightly less hurried pace, and that her car is almost like a kind of a sanctuary where, yes, there are intruders coming into it, and she has these interactions with her fares, but she herself feels like, I don't know, it just feels like there is more room for her to breathe than our Angela ever really gets.
Right.
And partly is that I suppose, for me, that our Angela's version of that is her TikTok videos, which are themselves also very, you know, exothermic. It's just like she's constantly there to be giving out energy, to be giving out heat and light, and, you know, interacting with things all the time, which is just so unbelievably exhausting. And you don't know, or I mean, I do know, I know my own conclusion to it, but like, how much of what we all do all the time to make ourselves feel better about our lives is actually the stuff that ends up distracting us from making our lives actually better, you know, in a fundamental way. Also, there's Uwe Boll.
Also,
Uwe Boll shows up.
Yeah. Yes. No, I mean, that's just another example of, like, he's having so much fun with this. Like, even the credits he has fun with.
But also then I was thinking about, like, the credits he's obviously having great fun with. They're completely handwritten, apparently, by Radu Judah himself. And there's lots of little annotations. Like, one guy gets, like, the greatest written beside it, and then there's a little heart drawn beside somebody else's credit, and he has like crossings out and things, because they're just marker written on sheets of paper. And then brilliantly, the corporate logos that he has to put at the end are not marker written on pieces of paper. They're on a computer screen, which is really crudely scrolled down. It's like, this is the least amount of effort I possibly could have put into giving credit to the various corporations and logos that I have to feature legally. In the very scanty production notes, which I love him for that as well, Judah refers to this as, he kind of joking, clearly tongue-in-cheek, but he's sort of saying, it is the most amateurish film I've ever made. But like, things like that are, you know, willfully amateurish, willfully showing the means of their construction. But then it was just occurring to me as well, like, this is one of the least hypocritical films I've ever seen as well. Because if it's going to be about the fallacy of these hierarchies of work, then of course he is the director, should be the guy who sits down with a piece of paper and writes the credits out in marker. And of course, like, any other way of doing this film would itself have been an example of exactly the thing that he is trying to critique here. So all of these sort of, all of its messiness, all of its jagged edges can really, I think, be justified, not just justified, but sort of become almost like transcendent examples of praxis, where he is talking about there has to be a better way of doing work, of making art, of even doing the business of making a movie, which is, I mean, this is after all a movie, we're at a film festival, festival, it is going to be shown in cinemas, and it's going to be, you know, get distribution and all of those things, which are all very corporatized, you know, packaged ways of doing things. But it's just like from its very aesthetic, from its very approach, from like the right down to the micro level, this is an example of doing it differently, of just, and it's what he's asking us to do. I think he's asking us very fundamentally to think like absolute basics about why it is that we live our lives the way we do, and who it is that our way of life and our way of work is actually benefiting, because it's not benefiting us.
Yeah, that's a good place to end, because I think that's a great way to put it all together. I mean, and just briefly while you were talking, and also just thinking of the title again, I'm flashing back to when he did his appearance at the New York Film Festival last, or whatever it would have been, 2 years ago maybe, last year for Bad Luck Banging. It was a video appearance. And he comes on and he has like a desktop background, which, if I remember correctly, it just flames. Like, not like he's in hell, but just like the world is just
burning. The world is burning, exactly.
And he was amazing. And I loved that screening. I remember it very fondly. It was a public screening. And there was just a line of like a family, I think like five sisters or like four sisters and a mother, and just laughing through the whole movie. And I just feel like his movies, I can't wait to watch this one with an audience, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And yeah, and I haven't seen, I still have many movies to see, but I kind of, for me, I don't see how this doesn't get a Golden Leopard.
I don't see how it doesn't either. I mean, to add to his already groaning mantelpiece.
Right.
This is genuinely one of my favorite films of the year. Yeah. And I'm so surprised to have found it here. I'm so surprised and delighted that. And there's also like the outside story that apparently both Venice and Cannes rejected this film, which just makes me think that they are insane, and actually makes me think slightly less of the selection teams in both of those places, because if you're going to go for something obviously starry and dull, yeah, over this incredibly creative, incredibly timely, mm-hmm, film, which is the kind of film that all of us come to a festival hoping to discover, I think your priorities are in the wrong place.
Yeah, that sucks. But yeah, it's out in the world now. They can't stop it.
Yeah.
We want to talk about a couple more films that from the earlier days, or like the first half of the festival. I think one other movie that actually coincidentally is also about exploitation, but is a historical drama called Sweet Dreams.
Anna Sendiarovich.
And this one is set in the Dutch Indies. And it's set basically, I guess, in like the last days or waning days of, you know, Dutch occupation, which is kind of ironic because it's not ironic, but I happen to have seen a photo or series of photos that Henri Cartier-Bresson did, about these final days, and they're incredible. I saw them in Amsterdam, I guess, last fall, and one of them is of this like Dutch sailor walking with, a woman from town, and I think it's labeled like the day of, or like the day before, the day after, you know.
Oh,
and
wow.
And he just has this angriest sort of look on his face. Anyway, so I thought about that image a little bit with this movie, and the basic premise of it. I mean, I call it a drama. Maybe that's not entirely accurate, because it's almost like at times like a satirical comedy as well, or just has those elements. It's about a plantation family whose patriarch kicks the bucket pretty soon in the movie, and then his kind of feckless seeming son, who you first see in close up, he kind of looks like he's a plastic doll, just sort of has not been exposed to the light, you know, for a while. And he comes with his wife, who's, you know, pretty far along pregnant and does not want to be there at all. And his mother is there and is sort of wants to just kind of keep on, even though there's not much to keep on about. Everyone has already walked off the plantation. So it's this interesting, you know, playing out of these final days, which I thought was, I was actually interested in the particular touch she brought to it, you know, because it's sort of this, but it's making fun, it's mocking the, it doesn't have much nostalgia for this like ruling class. And it also doesn't, I mean, there's an interesting character. I mean, one of the a woman who works for the family, who like kind of runs the household for them, she seems sort of two minds in terms of, you know, which way she's going to break. And she, I guess, has had a son with the patriarch, who's also an interesting figure. He has, like, he carries on a rifle at all times that he's bestowed on. The opening scene is the terrible, like, hunting of a tiger that he's allowed to do.
The kid is allowed to do.
But then there's also this guy who's kind of, like, courting her in this great kind of, like, I mean, honestly, it's like a, I don't know, it's almost like they have a kind of Hollywood, like, sarcastic banter between the two of them. Yeah. And I love that because it's not like, that's a different portrayal that you get.
He's the Reza. He's one of the workers. So this very wealthy or erstwhile wealthy Dutch family own a sugar plantation and the sugar factory that is attached to the plantation. But they live in this sort of the patriarch and his wife, this incredible frosty character, live in this exorbitantly luxuriant mansion in the old-fashioned style, even for the times. I think one of the interesting things is when the son finally comes to visit, he and his wife. I mean, actually, the early scenes of their relationship is also has that lovely sort of modern edge to it,
yeah.
Where they're also kind of taking the piss out of the old-fashioned furnishings,
yeah.
That her mother-in-law, that his mother, you know, still decks the house out in. So yeah, in this sort of like already passé place. And so Reza is one of the workers on the plantation. He's also one of the leaders of what has just happened, which is a strike, because the workers haven't been paid. So again, we're talking about work. Again, we're talking about exploitation and the capitalist classes. So Reza is one of the more firebrand of the workers who, you know, is insisting that they don't go back to work and they don't do the harvest until they can get paid. And he has a long-standing flirtation or love affair, whatever you want to call it, with Siti. And Siti is the woman who's really, I mean, becomes more and more the central character in this film. And certainly the film ends entirely with her in her perspective. And Siti herself, yeah, I think she really is a fascinating character. So she is the mother to this son who is obviously half white.
Carol.
Carol, yes, that's right. He's called Carol.
Right. And the other son is like, how is he called Carol?
Yes, exactly. It's really obvious that was the, you know, that's probably a family name. And the father of, like, the patriarch of the family, the elderly guy who dies quite early on in it, has for whatever reason taken Carol to his heart and really likes this kid, which obviously has completely spoiled Carol and also has turned him against his own skin. Basically, it has turned him inside out. It's one of the, like, great colossal cruelties of colonialism, not only the, you know, obvious torture and oppression that is visited on the victims of colonial rule, but also those of them who are sort of made to turn traitor to their own people. Certainly that's the case in Carol's case. He's just a little boy, but he, you know, he laughs when he sees other servants being beaten. He, you know, he's a cruel, horrible little child, and has been made that way because of his exposure to this incredibly corrupt, decadent, and like long past its sell-by regime, basically. So
right.
The way the plot of the film unfolds then is that it is actually discovered that when the grand old dude died, he had just before then left in his will, he had left everything to Carol, to the little half-breed boy, yes, and had basically disinherited then his white son who had been living over in Holland, and his, you know, unborn grandchild by his son. So obviously then there's machinations about like how they can get their inheritance back, or what they feel is their rightful inheritance back. And there's also this sort of undercurrent of labor unrest that is going on as well because of the strikers. And then there's this sort of like prelapsarian feel, or not prelapsarian, like peri-apocalyptic feel almost, because we're so much in that house and there is this real feeling that it is the decline of a particular type of civilization there. There's a lot of talk of the civilizing influence and that the priest character and everything. And the other thing that we should really say, I mean, I was really impressed by this film. I was really surprised at how good it is, but also how beautiful it is. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly well shot. It's very Academy ratio, very pictorialist photography style, but really not in such a way that it just becomes a sort of a show-offy thing or this is how it really starts to enrich the themes of the story and the sort of the framing of the story, I suppose. And there's just certain images that become incredibly striking then done in this way, where it almost becomes like these people are moving through a painted landscape, or they're moving through something that feels like almost mythic or something. Yeah. One of them in particular is that I keep on saying this, I think it's one of the greatest on-screen suicides I've ever seen, where a character kills themselves by drowning themselves in sugar, in the pouring silo pouring funnel of sugar. And it's just such a ridiculously poetic and incredibly beautiful image, and also of this incredibly disgusting, gruesome end, actually, that is also foreshadowed all the way through. There's lots of stuff with sugar all the way through. I mean, it's quite subtly done, but the white people are always spooning sugar, spoons of sugar into their tea. And it's an incredibly confident piece of work, an incredibly stylish piece of work for somebody's second film. And I really think, you're definitely going to see a lot more from this director. And that's normally what we say when we didn't like this film and we think, well, maybe there's something there. But no, honestly, this is the film itself is incredibly enjoyable. I mean, it like works on multiple different levels and has all of its sort of anti-colonialist rage credentials in order, but also then, as you're saying, has these interesting notes in how it plays, especially the relationship between Siti and Reza, and even the relationship between the son and his wife, that feel much, much more invested in them as characters rather than archetypes. So really a major recommendation for me.
Yes, and seeing how that next generation, what they're going to do, and whether it's going to be more of the same or in some way different.
Mm. Yeah, and it's also like from the very beginning, there's this ridiculous house in the middle of this very thickly verdant monsoon jungle kind of terrain. And the fact that all of they have a party, that the patriarch and his wife have a party at one point where they invite the other white Dutch landowners from nearby to come. And there's a string quartet or whatever of locals who are not very professionally playing, waltzes and by Strauss or whatever, like these sort of, proper, Western civilized white music, basically. But also all of the white characters in it, they're just constantly covered in sweat and mosquito bites. And even like the lady who has been living there for so long and is herself also kind of a fascinating character. I think she's a great character. There's no love lost between her and her philandering husband, certainly. And his death scene is quite amazing for her little gesture that she does. He's having a heart attack or something. This is quite early on in the film, so it's not a spoiler. He's having a heart attack or something on the bed, and reaches for a little bell to summon help. And she just very coolly snatches the bell away and watches him die. So these are the kind of people we're dealing with. They're not the best, but like even her, she in her high necked Edwardian gowns and everything, she's always immaculately made up, but also there's just this sheen of sweat underneath her sort of leaden pancake makeup. So it's just really textural, really sensuously shot, but also kind of a really entertaining, engrossing story.
Yeah, no, and I like that you talked more about her, because I thought the film was generally good at like getting to the interiority of the women and the very different situations that they're and the where very different ways each of them has to cope and kind of caught in double binds of various kinds. And I will add that I think, well, I don't know if it's the reason he's having a heart attack, but he's also just come from
raping his maid, basically. Also to bring it back again, I suppose, to Siti, because she is actually then what's really interesting about her then is that character would be very easy to make her the victim, to make her a very victimized character. And she herself has this absolute steely core of self-possession, especially when she's dealing with the constant attentions of Reza, who we know she is actually probably in love with, but she doesn't allow herself ever to you know, have anything that might constitute some kind of joy in her own life. But she has this incredibly rigid self-discipline, which makes her quite unlikable at times, and she does several extremely unlikable things. So again, it's even just allowing personhood and agency is a kind of an unpopular way. It would be a really easy shortcut to our sympathies to make her into this, you know, sort of wilting victim person. And she's absolutely not. She's a very strange, very cool, very ambivalent character all the way throughout it.
She kind of has have a poker face about a lot of stuff, but it's not like portrayed as mysterious or like, you know, exotic or something like this. It's just strategic. Because she has to.
Yeah, and even her dance that she has to do, that she has to perform for, it's incredibly beautiful. She's an incredibly beautiful actress, and she's very graceful, and she has this dance that she does. But in each case, it's like she is being told to dance for her white employers. And it's the expression, the absolute stone-faced expression that she wears while doing this incredibly sensuous, sinuous dance is just, it's a like a little mini essay in her kind of steely core of inner calm that she manages to put despite her evident exploitation.
Yeah. So that's Sweet Dreams. I think it's a competition
that's
title.
That's a competition, yes.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that movie being seen by more people. And I am a little curious if you just want to say a little bit about Mango de Terra, if that makes sense.
Mango de Terra, yes. So Mango de Terra is a Swiss-Portuguese director, Basil de Cunha. And initially, I was a little bit skeptical about this. It seems to be a story that I've seen a lot of times in like in different scenarios. But so basically, it's about a young woman called Rosa, who leaves her two children, who has left already, as the film begins, has left her two children in Cape Verde, where she's from, to settle in Lisbon to work, to make money, to send back. So this is a scenario that actually there's been quite a few recent festival movies have dealt in this kind of similar scenario, and actually specifically with Cape Verde as well. There was one in Cannes recently, and so this sort of like back and forth about like the trials of the forcibly exiled, I suppose, the economic exile, especially one who has left her own children, you know, in the care usually of her mother, of their grandmother, their grandparents, in order to be able to make enough money to send back to them, is one that has sort of been quite well traveled recently. And this one is has the other side of it, which is also, it's set mostly, she has moved to Lisbon, but she's moved to a very sort of basically a barrio section of Lisbon, a kind of a ghettoized section where there's lots of other Cape Verdeans and other African extraction, African immigrants around. And so there's like pockets of her own culture can be found there, but there's also a very hard, harsh undercurrent, a very violent undercurrent. And so I was already sort of on my guard, I suppose, against yet another kind of slightly poverty, porny, slightly obvious, I guess, narrative. And then this is one of those in some ways, but it then has this aspect to it, which I think completely lifts it. I did like this quite a lot, where at moments, it turns into a musical, not in the style of like a Busby Berkeley, everybody on the street is dancing. It's just she herself and the actress, the main actress who plays Rosa, who is called Eliana Rosa, is absolutely amazing. And so there's just these moments in it where she will be in the middle of some argument or in the middle of whatever mood it is. And there sort of just happens to be a band playing music, and it's a particular type of music from Cape Verde that is very, but is also very, has very modern influences. A lot of it is on sort of electric guitar as well. And she will go into a song, I think, and I presume these songs were specifically written for the film because they sort of tell a narrative story as well. The lyrics of them tell a narrative story, and the songs are so beautiful, and those sequences are so sort of transcendent that they lift the entire film. And I did find myself just waiting for the next one of those to happen. Because in between, you're sort of getting quite a familiar story of like the machismo that is around, and she's being very much, she's being mistreated by the woman who she has come to work for, and then sort of falls in with, she strikes up a kind of a flirtation with a young guy who is a rapper who is like a struggling rapper and who's himself is trying to make it in the music industry. And she has cherishes dreams of being a singer herself. And he, the rapper guy, has actually been incriminated in a recent attack on a police station. So there's lots of sort of social unrest stuff going on as well in this particular area. So there's this feeling, and there's police coming in and like riot police just coming in and riding roughshod over the rights of those citizens. So all of that very current social commentary is there. But then we have these the musical interludes, which somehow make it so much more and so much different from this sort of standard run-of-the-mill social commentary, right, that economic migration is such a challenging thing for so many people who have to undergo it. So just, it's very beautifully shot, and again, this the main performance is really magnetic. It's among my favorite things that I've seen here, because as I think I've said a lot recently, you know, when you go to a lot of festivals, it's not so much, you know, I'm not ever looking for perfection anymore. For the ideal version of some particular story that we've already seen, just for anything that does something a little bit different. And this, in its differences, this is really quite a remarkable little film.
Yeah, yeah. So that's Mongo de Terra from that siren.
Yes.
I know that we're at the end of the episode. It's very tough to arrange that, but it's happened now. But we can wrap up this first episode, and yeah, there'll be more movies to come. But thank you for... I'm so glad we could start off with Ratatouille. Every festival should start with this movie.
Yeah. I think we'll still be talking about it. There'll still be plenty to talk about, the next festival.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music from their song, Montserrat. Thank you for listening.